You're listening to The Point. In 1976, nine members of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe were arrested after police raided a gathering of tribal members participating in an evening drumming session. The police were in riot gear using mace and force to bring in the unarmed Wampanoag. Tribal member Paula Peters produced a documentary about the incident titled Mashpee Nine, The Beat Goes On, and has just published a book titled Mashpee Nine, A Story of Cultural Justice. And she joins us in our Woods Hole studio. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so give us some more details about what happened that night 40 years ago.
Well, there had been a community feast that had gone on all day long. And that evening, a group of men who had been drumming traditionally had stayed on the site because it was also the site of a 17th century style village that really just sprung up that summer. Part of a federally funded program that put the local people to work, and they were quite proud of this effort and creating this traditional village and had a lot of high hopes for the future of it. So they were staying there, protecting the tools and some of the supplies that had been left there, and they were permitted to be there as well.
So were gatherings of tribal members like this one unusual at the time?
I think this one was unusual. There was a lot going on that summer. It was unusual in the respect that they had produced this exhibit that was right in the center of town, and it evoked a lot of cultural pride. So in that respect, it was a little bit unusual, but you know, we had just come off of a successful powwow, which is always at that time of year. Yeah, there were quite a few folks that gathered in cultural pride.
So do you know why the police were originally called or why they came to disperse the group?
Well, I think that both the film and the book, I do try to put this whole story into context, which I think is really important. You have to understand that in 1976, the Cape in general was experiencing dramatic growth, but Mashpee in particular had been identified by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as the fastest growing town in the state. And I don't know what else to attribute it to, but it was rather a pristine hideaway on Cape Cod for so many years. I kind of point to the Kennedys a little bit because in the early 1960s, when JFK became president, it kind of put Hyannisport and Cape Cod on the map. And this pristine little hideaway suddenly became very attractive. So between 1965 and 1975, Mashpee grew by 300%. And that was largely not members of the tribe who had lived in this idyllic tribal paradise for years.
Was it unusual at that time that police from neighboring towns and state police would work together in tandem? And do we know why they were in riot gear?
I would say that was very unusual. In my research, I was really amazed to find that little piece of information that talked about something called the Cape Cod Regional Task Force, which was, by all the descriptions, easily an early SWAT team. They had been funded through the state since the early 1970s. I think they started funding it in 1970. And by 1976, they had really built up this elite force. It was like a few men from each town was practicing regularly. It was like a militia. And they had really built up this force, but they hadn't really done anything. And just a few weeks prior to this raid on the Mashpee Nine, the county commissioners said, "Hey, you guys, you know, this is all well and good that you can, you know, do these line formations and bring out your dogs and all that, but we don't need you because you haven't done anything in 6 years, so we're going to cut this funding."
In the book, you include a letter to the Falmouth Enterprise from one of the responding officers in the raid, Sergeant Alfred Gonzalez. How did the police story and the tribal members' accounts of the raid differ?
Well, of course they're going to differ. And I really wanted, in the book and in the film, to include that balance. You know, I come from a journalistic background, so it's important to me that, you know, I let the reader sort it out. I obviously have a bias toward my own people, but I wanted to be sure to include that. And Sergeant Gonzalez has since passed on, but I had that letter to show exactly how he was feeling, and he felt like, you know, his side of the story wasn't being told. And so I felt it was important to include that. And in general, I think there were police officers that felt like they weren't being represented properly, but they certainly weren't coming forward as I tried to track them down, which I was kind of diligent about that. So I can't really speak for them, but I did try to find them.
So what was the reaction of the tribe at the time?
Well, the tribe was, as you probably can recall from that period, the tribe was just about to file a precedent-setting land suit for return of lands in Mashpee. And we're coming up on that 40th anniversary. Actually, by the time this airs, I think it will have already happened. But I think it was a month to the day later, this land suit was to be filed. So the tribe was already feeling the pressure of all of the growth in the community and the changes in town leadership, which was not very conducive to the tribal lifestyle in the community, which had gone on there for hundreds of years. So the tribal leadership and the tribal community were outraged by what happened. Mm. And it sort of laid the groundwork for what was about to come.
Mm. Attorney Lewis Gerwitz came to the defense of those arrested. Tell us more about him and how he crafted a defense.
He was amazing. The people of Mashpee came to really know and love him so well. He came in looking kind of like a rustic kind of cowboy almost. He wore a Stetson hat and cowboy boots and denim and casual clothes most of the time. We were really, really very surprised to see him when we first saw him in a suit in a courtroom. Mm-hmm. But he was amazingly skilled, and he had been representing Native people in Indian country for a number of years. And when this case came to his attention and he had an opportunity to come back to Massachusetts, because he'd been working out west and work for people in his own community, he jumped at the chance. And he knew a lot about representing Native people from an Indigenous perspective. He was very sensitive to our needs as people and how we should be represented. And he was responsible really for having that courtroom be the first place that we know of that ever allowed for Native people to use the pipe instead of a Bible to swear upon, because that was the place where we would pledge our allegiance to truth.
Mm. So what was the outcome for the trial after the trial?
Yeah, you know, and this isn't even really a spoiler alert. At the end of 10 months, they were found not guilty. It was an important verdict. And one of the things that Lou had told the men upon agreeing to represent them for virtually pennies and a place to sleep and a hot meal now and again was that he wanted this fight to be about not just the 9 men, but about the importance of the drum to the community. And it really did become that. And one of the reasons why I wanted to pull this story out at this important anniversary was because we do still take great pride in the drum to this day. And there are many young people who, I wouldn't say that they take it for granted, but they didn't realize the sacrifice that had gone on in order for them to have that privilege.
Mm. The epilogue of the book describes an encounter you had in 2015 when you were asking tribal members to recount their memories of this incident in 1976. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, there was one young man, he's not young anymore, but he was young then, who I knew he had been there that night. I knew he had witnessed a lot of what had gone on. And I would go around the community regularly and ask people for their recollections. And people were generally very, very happy to tell me. And this gentleman was not, he was holding back. And I could tell that he was a little uncomfortable about telling his story. He says, yeah, you don't want to know. And I said, no, I do want to know. I think everybody's story lends context to the story overall. And whatever it was that happened, you know, you can tell me, you know, and I'll either keep it just between us or I'll share it more broadly. And what he told me just broke my heart, because he told me that he had been on the scene that night, and he had experienced as a 15-year-old child just a sense of rage and injustice that he picked up a stone and he threw it, and it hit one of the police cars and broke a window. And then he ran. And he said, I haven't told anyone this story in 39 years. And then he wept. And he became my muse for actually writing the story. Because up to that point, I was just doing a film.
So how has the tribe's relationship with law enforcement changed over the years? And has it?
Well, it has changed. We've had some serious issues with law enforcement. There was the case with the officer David Mays, who had killed a tribal member on Main Street in Mashpee in the 1980s, and I'm not going to remember that date exactly. We felt like there was never justice for David Hendricks' death. That's another way long story, but I think in more recent years, partially due to the fact that we have more tribal members that are police officers, not enough, but some, and now we have this relationship with tribal police and town police working together, I think that that has improved relations with the tribal community in general to a large degree. But having never been arrested or even stopped by the police, I can't speak from experience in Mashpee.
What do you hope readers of the book and those who see the documentary take away from this incident?
Well, there's the incident itself. And I want to say that I revived this story because I was really fearful that it would just fade away with the voices of those who remembered it. It was very hard to research, being that we didn't have Google and the internet back in the 70s. So that was stuff that I had to really painfully scroll through microfilm and probably miles of it to find the tidbits that I needed. But it was important for the young people in the community to know about that sacrifice. And I think that, and I've heard this actually from community members who aren't tribal members, who just never knew this part of their history. And it's not that long ago. It was in our lifetime.
Yeah. Paula Peters is a Mashpee Wampanoag tribal member who has produced both a documentary and a book about the Mashpee Nine. We'll have more with a link with information at our website, capeandislands.org. Paula, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.